It's Wednesday and you're in the moment. Host Lori Walsh is back tomorrow. I'm Kara Hetland here today with Keely Boltina.
Demonstrators in Cannonball, North Dakota gained international attention as thousands sought to halt construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Now a new administration has given the go-ahead for the project and protesters have to leave federal land in just 3 hours.
Officials say they've spent weeks cleaning up what demonstrators have left behind. And joining us on the phone right now today is Morton County Emergency Manager Tom Deering. Thanks so much for being with us today on In the Moment.
Good morning.
So let's start. The cleanup process has been going on for what, about a month, 4 weeks or so?
Couple weeks.
So talk about...
Since January 30th.
Okay, so paint me a picture of what it looked like January 30th.
Well, it was all snow-covered garbage, personal belongings that were left behind, tentage, clothes, food, and that was trapped under the snow from the two blizzards that we had. The last blizzard around Christmas, that's when everybody, a lot of the people that were staying there decided to get out and left a lot of their belongings and donated goods behind.
And since then, we've had, what, 50, 60-degree temperatures, and the snow's melted. So what does it look like today?
It's pretty much just a big mud hole today. So, it's likely that some contaminants have leached into the groundwater now due to the warm conditions and the melting snow that we've had. But we're up to 238 loads that we've taken out. That's a combination of several contractors, some that were hired by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And then some that we hired, Morton County hired to do the cleanup.
And when you say loads, are you talking what size of a truck?
We're calculating it all by 30 cubic yard loads.
And when you say contaminants, what kind of contaminants are you referring to?
Well, there's about 80 abandoned vehicles. So you've got the issue with, vehicle lubricants, gasoline. You got food, which that has to be disposed of in a lined landfill, raw food items. We've seen video of them digging sump holes and pouring in kitchen waste. And other than that, we really don't know. I mean, we found a lot of propane canisters. When they left, after the heavy snowfall, we don't know what's in the snow, and so we have hauled a lot of snow away, and so it's going to be very expensive, because the landfills are charging by the ton. But we don't know what's in the snow, so it has to get hauled away.
And so you're going in like with a backhoe to clean it up, or how are you getting in there to get this stuff out?
Yeah, well, we were in over the weekend with a D5 Caterpillar crawler tractor dozer and 2 5-yard payloaders, a track hoe, an excavator, and using that equipment to load, scoop everything into piles and then get it loaded up. And due to the muddy conditions, it's been a real bear because, they've had to actually push some of the trucks out with the dozer just to get them up onto the road to get them out.
And who's paying for this? Who's responsible for the cleanup?
Well, Morton County is going to bear the cost initially, and then with the state emergency declaration, we're hope to be reimbursed.
From who? Who would pay you back? Federal government?
The state emergency fund, which they've had to increase several times now.
But this is all on federal land, correct?
Correct. Yep. It's in Morton County, but the camp is on federal land. Correct. Yep.
Do you consider this to be an emergency?
It is an emergency. We can't allow trash, rubbish, debris, pollutants, contaminants, human waste. We can't allow that to get into the Missouri River. And where we got impending flood conditions on that river, that camp is in a floodplain. And historically, the ice that comes through there in sheets scours the top of that land almost bare, where the camp is now.
Now you have, I mean, this is your home county. And so what would you estimate how many people were there at any given time? Are we talking thousands?
Numbers, yeah, the numbers range from 500 to 800 at its highest point, living there for a couple of months. And so you can about imagine how much trash they accumulated.
And we have talked with one of the protesters who have recently left, and she said that it's really not that bad, and you're making a mountain out of a molehill.
Well, just look, all you have to do is look at the pictures, video.
I saw a picture tweeted today that some of the people who are about to leave are kind of burning down structures. What is that doing?
I don't know. So I haven't been able to identify if they're actually burning structures or just general debris that from structures that have been torn down.
And it would be up to you to help remove what's left, everything that's left behind. Some of the structures that the tents and the poles and that kind of stuff as well.
Right. All that material has to go.
So it has to go, and then do you have to sort it and separate it, or does it just all go to the landfill and you pay the fee?
They've been asked to take what they want with them, and hopefully they're working to do that today. Anything that's sacred or cultural that they want to save, we've been asked that they take that down themselves and bring that with them. Now, if they want us to dispose of it, we will.
Okay. Tom Deering, I want to thank you for taking time and coming on the program today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Tom Deering with the Morton County, North Dakota Emergency Management.
Yeah, absolutely. That was an interesting perspective. Some protesters have a different version of what that camp near Cannonball looks like. Jazz Jewett is a Lakota woman from Cheyenne River. She demonstrated against the Dakota Access Pipeline before returning home for a while. And I asked her a couple of different questions yesterday. We're talking with you today because you were just up at the protest site for the Dakota Access Pipeline. Tell me what it looks like.
Well, it's springtime, and springtime in South Dakota means there's a lot of flooding, there's a lot of mud. That's what's pretty much happening up there. It's a place where tens of thousands of people have camped. And so there's, residual stuff. A lot of people are trying to pick up what they can and get out of there with what they can. But like for me, myself personally, I had to get pulled out of there in a dually pickup with a bulldozer because the roads are so bad. So it's not a good situation. Moving in the middle of winter is never something that people should be doing, I think.
There's the issue of the mud and the thaw and the water, but then there is also the issue of garbage and cleanup. So people have a right to come together, but whose responsibility is it to clean this place up now?
See, I mean, that's so amazing that so many people are so concerned about the cleanup. And it's like no one's really asking the questions about the Missouri River, but everyone's, you know, ready to assume that we're messing things up there. There's not an ecological mess. I don't know, you know, where that came from or what happened. You know, there's no you know, big disaster up there happening. I just left. There's, you know, it's just not the situation. There's, you know, camping stuff. There's structures there. You know, our camp went from two teepees and a tent to, you know, seven big, huge army tents and, you know, a couple of other structures. So we have to, you know, take the time to get rid of all that stuff. I mean, I think that, you know, it's just a, you know, overwhelming amount of stuff that, you know, now there's, you know, tens of thousands of people who came in. There's only like 200, 300 people left up there cleaning stuff up. So, you know, I went up yesterday. I had my family help me. We had, you know, seven of us, and we took down three tents and a yurt. So, you know, it's happening. There's not, you know, I don't know where all this the concern about the ecological mess came from, because it's just not, you know, an issue. Sure, there's stuff up there, but no one plans on leaving it. You know, no, that was never, you know, an issue for no one had, you know, plans on leaving it. We're being forced out of there. So, you know, that's what's happening there.
Wednesday is the deadline. So what are the people who are still there going to do? I mean, you went up and you came back. People are leaving. People are taking as much of the stuff you talk about with them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we got, you know, folks donated stuff and now we have to haul that away, and folks donated a lot of stuff. And, you know, I left because, you know, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe asked us to leave, and, you know, I'm respecting the tribe's wishes. You know, I'm still totally opposed to the pipeline and, you know, totally, you know, there to, you know, down to protect water. But, you know, if the locals don't want us there, we have to leave. So that's why I left.
Jez Jewett, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Officials do say that there are concerns, and we just heard from the emergency manager about the trash.
Right, and there's the issue of sanitation so that people don't get sick in Cannonball or downstream. Dave Glott is the acting director of the North Dakota Department of Health, and he joins us live on the phone today. Dave, welcome to In the Moment.
Yeah, good morning.
Hey, Dave, I want to get your reaction to this concept that it seems like different people have different versions of what the campsite looks like, what's there, and then what kind of a threat that poses to health. So how do you describe it?
Well, yeah, first and foremost, it's not about a pipeline issue or anything else. It's about being on a floodplain, having 8,000 to 10,000 people camping there for a period of time. You are going to have impacts. What we're seeing now is, you know, we've had over 300 truckloads of trash being removed from the site. That is trash that won't end up in the river if that area floods. So there are continuing to be concerns regarding all the stuff that was accumulated over the period of time. There is some concern about, you know, the human waste issue. You can't have that many people in a location and say that there are no impacts. That's just there are impacts. And then you have the chemical issues, the abandoned cars, and those type of things that just have to get pulled off the floodplain. If you don't do that, it all ends up in the river. And that is what everybody can agree on, is that that's what should be protected. And that's what the state is working towards, along with the Army Corps of Engineers, and also with the volunteers down there to get that material off the floodplain.
So if you can only fix one part of the issue, where do you start? What is the absolute most important element to try to preserve health?
Well, I think you just try to get all the trash off the landscape. There are concerns about material that has been buried out there, and there are pictures showing pits that stuff has been dumped into. That I don't think we'll be able to address in the short term. But in the short term, it's just getting all the material off the land as quickly as possible.
And if that material gets into the river, sure, it's garbage and it shouldn't be there and it, you know, is unsightly, but connect that to the public health issue.
Well, first and foremost, the materials such as trash, that can become a physical hazard. Containers, propane tanks, those type of things, floating down the river can create problems for people who want to enjoy the river. Second, any of the biological material getting into the river, depending on where that and how long it stays in the river, that can create issues for people who want to enjoy the river. Can it create issues for people that utilize it for drinking water sources? Those are all things that we work very hard at trying to keep out of the river through the various programs that we have. And so that those are the type of things that we are concerned about moving forward, is making sure that that doesn't get into the river and then create physical or chemical hazards for people who utilize the river.
And I know you work with the North Dakota Health Department, and that deals with people, but I assume then that some of these concepts can translate to wildlife and just the ecology of the area.
That's exactly right. You know, and I think you look at the full picture. First and foremost, it's the protection of safety and health of individuals. Second, we want to maintain the aquatic ecosystem, try to not to have negative impacts on that. That is a concern to us as well. And so we work trying to, if we maintain the ecological balance and the pristine nature of the river, that is a good thing and that benefits everybody.
Help me understand then what happens downstream if things do get into the river. We know what, you know, what happens upstream, but does that really, for lack of a better term, trickle down?
It can. You know, obviously, you work hard to try to keep everything out of the river that isn't natural. And things such as tents, inert material that just doesn't break down quickly, that will be there for a long period of time. Years into the future, people will be dealing with this material. So to keep it out of the river, that's first and foremost. I do think there are some good steps going forward. People are doing that, but they still, with the rain and the melt and the mud that's occurring out there, that's creating some challenges. And hopefully they'll continue to be able to have some time to get that material off of the landscape.
And so, but if the demonstrators have to be gone in less than 3 hours, then that really does, we were talking earlier with the emergency manager, shift the burden away from the people who were there and whose items those were, and it transfers it to North Dakota.
Well, the first and foremost, if this is land, Army Corps of Engineers land, they have a responsibility to make sure that the land that they have responsibility for does not impart a negative or adverse impact on the river. So they, is my understanding, they do have contracts in place where they can come in and expedite the cleanup, and we're hopeful that that will happen as we move forward.
And can that land be restored so that public health is not an issue into the future? I mean, is it just going to take time, months, years, or is this something that we just don't really know if we can get it back to the way it was?
Well, we're hopeful. That's not something that's going to happen this season. That's going to take a couple years for it to get back to its natural condition. There's quite a number of people that were there for a long period of time. You're going to have areas that need to be reseeded. You have to have areas that material that was buried. They're going to have to assess how much of an impact that will have on water quality going forward, not only the river, but local groundwater quality. So that will take several years for it to get back to where you won't be able to tell that people were out there on the land.
Dave Glott is Acting Director of the North Dakota Department of Health. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You are listening to In the Moment. I am Keely Pina here with Kara Hetland. The State Theater in downtown Sioux Falls opened in 1926, and it closed in 1990. More than $3 million has been spent in recent years to replace and upgrade key infrastructure and to restore parts of the building, including the lobby and the bathrooms.
And joining In the Moment is John Swedeen, who is the president of the State Theater Company, to talk about the project and an upcoming gala. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. So let's start. You've been president of the State Theater for how long?
14 months.
14 months.
I retired in March of 16, And I had some free time in my hands. I've been involved in the state for years before that. Mm-hmm. I love the project. I love the mission and the vision. So I got involved on the board and was elected president in January of 16.
So this has been, the restoration of the State Theater has been going on quite a while.
It certainly has. We hired an expert out of Vermont that's done over 30 of these historic theater renovations. And he tells us it takes about 16 years to get a project like this completed.
Why? Why so long?
It's a function of fundraising. It really is. We've had a very successful fundraising campaign in 2012, mm-hmm. a public campaign. We raised over $2 million. We've raised a lot of money since then, but we need $4.5 million left to complete the project.
$4.5 million more over the $3 million you've already spent.
Almost $4 million. And all that money, mm-hmm. people ask the question, where did the money go? All mm-hmm. that money went into the infrastructure of the building. It's a 90-year-old building. It had to be brought up to code, and all new HVAC, a new roof, all new systems to get it up to code. We've done that. We're ready to go. We've finished the lobby, the bathrooms, the main concession area, and now it's on to the fun stuff, restoring the auditorium. The stage, the screen, and the balcony. That's the final phase of the project.
That's it. That's all that's left.
That's all that's left. Yeah, right.
She says, right? It's easy to say, but not to do.
We've got a plan. We have a budget. We've got a 5-year financial pro forma. We've got our ducks in line. Now it's a function of continuing to raise money. We're actively engaged in fundraising, which we have a big event coming up on Sunday, I'm sure we'll talk mm-hmm. about. But it's a function of raising the money. Once the money's raised, we have an 11-month construction schedule, and we'll get that thing open for the city of Sioux Falls.
What's your dream for what it's going to be?
That's another reason why it's taken some time. We are bound to restore the theater to its original beauty and luster. We are going to replicate the theater as it was built in 1926. There's so much art. There's so much hidden gems in the building. To restore the stencil on the walls, for example, several hundred thousand dollars. And picture Michelangelo on the, it's not quite that complicated, but we have to restore the stencil work inch by inch to reveal the original artwork underneath the layers of gold and red paint that some smart individual threw on the walls back in the 50s and 60s.
So it's not just scraping it off, it's preserving
it. It is, in fact. And that's very time consuming, but that's just one example. Every mm-hmm. doorknob in the place, every vent in the place has got to be replaced. And of course, the art, the acoustic curtains, the stage, the new screen. Everybody wants to talk about the balcony. It's a pretty emotional space in town. That's got to be restored. All the offices have to be restored. The third floor has to be restored. The projector room. So it's a complex project that we've got prioritized and a plan to execute once we have the funds.
Why is the balcony so emotional?
I can't tell you the stories we hear about the balcony. They start
lots
with,
of smooching going on up there.
Here's my favorite. I got my first kiss in the balcony. Uh-huh. When you bring people that have history in mm-hmm. Sioux Falls into that space, even in its current under-construction phase, they look around and they just regale you with stories about my grandma used to drop me and my cousins off here back in the 60s after Thanksgiving dinner to watch matinees, or I already said, I got my first kiss in the balcony. People have had wedding proposals, marriage proposals in the theater, and a lot of great experiences that people love to recount. There's a lot of passion in this town among all generations to get the theater opened.
Now, talk a little bit about, with digital technology, how much restoration to the projector room needs to really happen? Well, things are smaller now, right?
The technology is changing as we speak. We actually had a grant for $60,000 to buy a projector 3 years ago. That projector won't work today. There's new and mm-hmm. exciting technology. Right. And one of the things we're going to do is not only restore the theater to its original look and splendor, we're going to use all the current and advanced technology, all the way from showing films to live entertainment. Our ticketing strategy is all technology driven. So there's a number of areas in the technology world, and we've brought a young man on from the Disney company that's got a lot of experience on the tech side that is helping us, stewarding us through that process as well.
So when you did all of the infrastructure improvements, how many years ago?
That was completed in 13 and 14.
And things and technology has changed a lot since then.
It has, in fact.
Do you wish you would have done something different?
Well, we'd be upgraded. It probably would have been serviceable, but we would have been looking to upgrade. But now we're ready to go. We know what we want to do with it. But one of the opportunities we had as a board of directors was to settle on the programming piece of this. And our mission is all about inclusivity. We're going to have the theater open every day for everybody, all ages, all income groups in the city of Sioux Falls. We're going to have live performance. We're going to have film. We'll have poetry reading. I like to say we'll do everything in that space but tractor pulls. We probably won't do tractor pulls in the State Theater, but it'll be available for rent for business meetings. We're going to expand the stage so we can have weddings. It's going to be a magnificent space that will be multi-use when it's opened.
How many does it seat?
We're looking at 900. When the last film shown there, besides our film this summer, I'd like to tell you about that, was in 1991, and the seating was 1,200. People's configurations have changed a bit since the theater was built in 1926. So we are going to be about 900, which is a really sweet spot in the city in terms of entertainment venues, which will appeal to a lot of acts and entertainers out there. That's a good number of seats to bring in really talented, high-caliber talent. But the seats are going to be comfortable, and they're going to fit.
Not authentic.
We're replicating the original look on all of them,
but a little larger.
We need to go. It's like the Mayflower. You know, those folks fit a lot of folks in the Mayflower. We can't. You know, people have changed sizes a bit.
Okay, so Sunday you have a gala.
We do. It's a star statue in the state. We've run it for a number of years, and this year we're bringing it home. We've held it at the Icon Lounge the last several years, and now we're bringing it home to the state.
It's going to be at the State Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so walk me through what this is.
It's going to be a great evening. A group of volunteers have been working tirelessly to get the place ready. We're talking red carpeting. We're talking chandeliers and the scaffolding. We're talking showing the Oscar, the Academy Awards live on the big screen at the State Theater. It'll be catered by a number of people. Chef Dominique is going to cater the food with his team. We've got a number of great retailers and folks in towns that have given us a number of donations, cash and in-kind donations. We have a number of sponsors that will enable this to be a world-class event. Black tie, ladies in their elegant dresses.
Just like going to the Oscars.
Just red carpet, the whole thing.
Okay. And ticket space still available?
You know, if I was here last week this time, we would have had 50 tickets. We're oversold, as a matter of fact, regrettably. So for anybody that wants to buy, we're thrilled that we're oversold. And the key is our attendee list. It's an amalgam of all Sioux Falls citizenry. It's the right folks with deep pockets, and it's folks that have a lot of passion and want to volunteer. So our message that night is all about fundraising. We have a significant matching gift that will be revealed Sunday night, and our goal is to hit that gift and hopefully exceed that gift and continue our efforts and our fundraising strategy.
Okay. Talk a little bit about the State Theater from a statewide perspective and why people, you know, outside of Sioux Falls should care about this project.
You know, everybody, there was a time that communities, cities, states tore down historic theaters. That doesn't happen anymore. I was just in Nashville a couple weeks ago, and they've got five wonderful historic theaters, but they tore down two, and they converted those into parking lots and into office buildings. People don't want to see that anymore. The Homestead Opera House out in Lead is a great example. They are in the process of restoring that. There are other historic theaters and smaller venues across our state that have been restored that are in the process of restoration. People really, really are rallying around the call to make sure that these historic spaces are not only preserved, but they're put to good use from a programming standpoint. Everybody you talk to, we had focus groups last summer. We had 84 folks that were across the age continuum, a lot of downtown Sioux Falls business owners, a lot of really interested parties, and we spent several hours with them to make sure that what we were going to use the State Theater for was appropriate for their needs. But the big takeaway from that was the passion people have for that space. Think about it. It's on Phillips Avenue. Look at the hundreds of millions of dollars that have gone into Phillips in Maine and downtown Sioux Falls, and we've got an unused, empty, iconic theater called the Sioux Falls State Theater right there in South Phillips Avenue. So people really have a lot of emotion and passion to get it done.
Has there been talk to tear it down?
No, but back in the day, there was some talk about an office conversion. There was some talk, you know, when downtown Sioux Falls, if you go back into the back a ways, needed some work. Well, that work's been done. I mean, there's beautiful, well, there's 10,000 people living downtown. The retail establishments downtown, the restaurants, there's so many entertainment venues downtown that those days are past. Nobody's talking about tearing it down. We own the building. The Sioux Falls State Theater Board and Company own the building. So that's really a leg up in terms of the preservation outcome. But that building's going to do one thing. It's going to be open for daily use for everyone in the community.
Is there restoration fatigue in talking about the State Theater?
That is a great question. As I've been involved in this, the fundraising part of this for 14 months, and I've met with a lot of key folks in town, there is a certain fatigue, and there is a certain skepticism. Why is this taking so long? I thought the public campaign, the community appeals campaign, was going to finish it. Well, we probably didn't do as good a job articulating that via various media to the community to tell them where we are. This is a phased project. We had the money earmarked for infrastructure. We got that done. And that's gnarly work, pulling out asbestos. I mean, that's gnarly work, but it's done. It's not very sexy, but you got to get the building established before you can do restore the inside
of the
fun stuff. Right. So there is some, but as we explain to people what's happened over the last several years, and particularly the last 2 years, they are mollified and they seem to understand that this is a phased project, and we're a group of volunteers with one commitment to get it done.
Well, I have to tell you, one of the first stories I did as a reporter in 1990 was the closing of the State Theater.
Mm.
Not to date myself. Or the project.
Yeah.
But it has been a long process.
And let's face it, all the multi-generational families in town that have so many deep roots in Sioux Falls, they remember going to the State Theaters in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we had a great event there last summer. We showed The General, a silent movie. We brought on the Alloy Orchestra. So talk about full circle. Talk about a time capsule. We showed The General with orchestral backup to a room full of 300 people in temporary seating. The balcony was full. Everybody always goes to the balcony first. It's just that's like a captivate. I'm not sure much, but it was a really, really magical afternoon. And since then, we've had other events there. Downtown Sioux Falls used it for their first Friday and had two films. We had to turn people away. So people want to get in there.
Okay. John Swedina, I want to thank you for taking time and coming on In the Moment today.
I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Headings in the paperback include The Easter Bunny, Bad Driver, You're Stuck in the Mud, and my favorite, Crazy Town. Adam Weber is lead pastor at Embrace Church in Sioux Falls. He's here in our studio at the University of Sioux Falls. Welcome, Adam.
It is fantastic to be here. Just fantastic.
Sounds great. So I want to start. Just tell me what the point of talking with God, what to say when you don't know how to pray is. Yes, I'm asking you to sum up 204 pages in a sentence.
Yeah, prayer is one of those things that we've heard a lot about. And we've heard so much about it, actually, that we feel strange asking questions about it. It's one of those things that, you know, what do you say to someone going through a tragic thing? My thoughts and prayers are with you. So we talk often about prayers. I'm praying for you, pray for the country, whatever. But because we've heard about it so much, we feel awkward asking questions. It's like when you are friends with someone or you work with someone, after a certain point, it's too late to ask what their name is because that's just awkward.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think prayer is for so many people. I grew up in the church. I didn't, but I heard a lot about it. I feel like I should know this, but I don't know how to. And so it's really just a simple book on prayer and how to talk with God. And what does it look like to pray? Not on Sundays for an hour, or even, you know, if you're a good church person, for 10 minutes when you wake up and 10 minutes before you go to sleep. But what does it look like to talk with God in the midst of life, with schedules and kids and lawns that need to be mowed and dogs that need to be walked? Like, in the midst of reality, what does it look like to talk with God?
And this is a more contemporary focus on a conversation with God. This is not the tried and true across the board accepted prayers that people have memorized and say over and over and over for that tradition. This really is an emphasis on the conversation.
Great question. Yes, it's so true. It's definitely focused more on conversational prayer. And I grew up traditional Lutheran. My extended family on the Weber side is Catholic. And have actually a deep appreciation for liturgy and traditional worship. And so it's not in opposition of that. It's really just an approach of what it looks like to conversationally prayer and pray and talk with God. And actually in my own prayer life, a lot of it is fairly liturgical. Like, I think there's really power in reciting prayers that have been prayed for years and hundreds of years. But this definitely is more of a conversational approach to prayer.
Okay, so I want to read this excerpt here from the beginning of the book, and this is in your voice, but it's coming out in my voice. It says, "I'll go out on a limb and say that the majority of everyone else doesn't have prayer figured out either. They have questions. They feel unqualified or inadequate. They avoid prayer altogether. After all, how do you talk with the creator of the entire universe without feeling a little intimidated? And so I offer this book to you. It's a book on prayer for everyone else. It's for the church outsider, the recognized sinner, the baptized and confirmed Christian, the faithful churchgoer, the follower of Jesus who feels like she falls short, and the Pharisee Christian who thinks he doesn't." That, I mean, what does that, obviously we hear the words, but what does that mean? Put that in context for us, or application.
Yeah, because again, prayer is one of those things that everyone else has figured out. And except ourselves, we always convince ourselves, gosh, they are so good. They're such a good church person. They know exactly what to say, and their prayer life is probably wonderful. And so it's always one of those everyone else things, but actually everyone else doesn't have it figured out. I'm a pastor. I'm paid to pray and grow my relationships and the others' relationship with God. And yet myself, I'm a work in progress. And so if I don't have it figured out, I'm guessing a whole lot of other people feel like they don't have it figured out either. And so my hope is that it's a book on prayer that meets people right where they are, not where they feel like they should be.
And how should people read this book? Is this a sit down and go through it and get through it book? Is it a take a section a night book? Is it a no, you just open it and throw it open when you don't know what else to do and you just read whatever's on the page? Or is there another option that I'm not hitting
on? Maybe all of the above. Maybe all of the above. I've talked with a few people who sat down and read it start to finish and I said, I'm so sorry. Like, I apologize for everything you just read. And then there's been other people who actually read two chapters. And it was probably honestly one of the most kind words I could hear. They said, I was reading and I put it down and I actually started praying. Hmm. And I was like, wow, I that was probably the coolest compliment I've gotten. The person who read it start to finish, he was so impacted. It was cool that he ended up buying a copy for all of his colleagues. So I don't think there's a right or wrong way to go through it. It's super conversational, so it will not, it's...
Right, there are not lots of big, complicated words or, you know, incredible, difficult-to-follow sentence structure in here. I mean, this is conversational writing.
Yeah, I promise I do have an education and a degree as well. When you go through it, you're like, this is so simple. Which third-grade kid wrote this book? Because it definitely is conversational, and that's really my personality in general. Like, it's just... is not trying to sound like someone I'm not, but really just conversation. I hope that you feel like the reader and myself had coffee together and we're talking about prayer together.
As we talk about the mechanics of this book, though, you use a lot of sentence fragments or just words followed by punctuation. But I assume the point of that is that it's a cadence, that you're
yes.
reading it and you're feeling it more than you are, you know, subscribing to grammatical rules.
Absolutely. That was my hope. Actually, in talking with the publisher before we wrote, I said, I really have a conversational writing style and it's not full sentences.
So from the beginning, it was like just a heads up.
Just a real heads up.
I'm writing a book that's not complete sentences.
I actually had a friend go through it in the editing process and he came up to me really serious. And this was like quite late in the process that he got it. And he said, Adam, you realize most of these sentences are not sentences. He was like deeply concerned. And I'm like, yeah, I know that. And he still was like, oh my goodness. And they're going to allow to publish this and then put it in Walmart. I'm like, I don't know what that means, but yes. But no, it really is that conversational approach and just, and really stress and feelings and different thoughts. I think when we think and also when we pray, it doesn't come out in these beautiful sentences. Instead, it comes out in bits and pieces. I'm broken. What's going on here? You know? And so I think that's our prayer life. And hopefully it even connects with people in that way, is this is something I can relate with. And maybe I hate to admit that I can relate with it at different points.
How does South Dakota play into your book? You reference it a few different places intentionally.
Yeah. So I don't know what it was, but the last week I had the manuscript. No kidding. I thought to myself, how can I shove as much South Dakota in this book as I possibly can? No kidding. There was one night I was up till 2 o'clock in the morning and I was like, what else can I add? So I added the Corn Palace. Clark is where I went to high school in, so I had to mention mashed potato wrestling in Clark, famous people from South Dakota. But I'm just a born and raised South Dakotan. I was on an interview yesterday and they said, how did you end up in South Dakota? And I was like, I've always wanted to ask like my great grandparents who came from Norway and Germany the same exact question. But South Dakota is a place, it's home for me. And so much of my story is wrapped up in that.
One of the moments you reference is you write, my nightly walks are usually around downtown Sioux Falls. I live close by, and it's a beautiful area that is undergoing an economic revival. While I walk, I'm usually talking to myself, talking to God, saying hello to passersby, and listening to Hillsong United. I love my walks. Do people who are not in downtown Sioux Falls connect with that? Whether that means they're in a different part of South Dakota or a different part of the country?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I think they will, because in another part of my story, I'm out in the middle of nowhere, South Dakota. Which is right around Henry, South Dakota. And that's actually the very first time I ever really prayed from my own heart, my own words. And so that was in the middle of really nowhere. I pulled my car over on the side of Highway 212, actually, between Clark and Watertown. And that was my first exchange. But I think that it will. Another chapter is on Crazy Town, and I just talk about the craziness of life and what that looks like. And I think whether you're a young professional living in Chicago or someone who is a rural farmer in South Dakota, I think it will be something that you'll see bits and pieces of yourself and your own story and be a place of connection. So that's a great, really great question, though. But some of my favorite places, so we have a little lake place that we go to up on Lake Elbert. It's right by Lake Ponset, and that's one of my favorite places to talk with God. There's not even a farm light to be seen, and so the stars, it just, there's something about being under stars that reminds you how big, I would say, a creator or God is in contrast to myself. So there's that, but then also on my nightly walks, I just went on one again the other night. There's something about walking for me that just kind of brings it out. There might be some people I walk quite late, so it's like 9 or 10 at night. There's people who probably think I'm talking to myself, but
worry about you a little. But really, it's meditative. It's introspective.
Yeah. Hopefully they take a moment to pray for me, the crazy fool who's walking by on their sidewalk.
So. There you go. Is this book prescriptive or is it permissive? Is this a situation where you're telling people what to do, or you're just saying, you know what, it's okay that this is how you do it?
Yeah, I would definitely say it's okay. There's no right or wrong way to connect with God. Some of us connect through God with God through music, through nature, through completely unplugging in the midst of our busyness. I've seen people connect with God more there than any place else. And so you definitely won't hear this is the right way and this is the wrong way to pray and talk with God. You won't hear that at all. It'll be more of, hey, here's what I'm learning. Here's what I'm wrestling with. Here's what the Bible has to say. Here's what some friends have had to say. And so that will definitely come out as well. Yeah, it's definitely not. I have nothing figured out. So anything in the book that sounds like I have something figured out, I don't. It's a complete lie.
You're not supposed to admit that on the air.
Seriously.
I wonder if people who are not looking for Christian prayer pick up your book, what can they still take away from it if they don't subscribe to all of the same beliefs that you have?
Great question. I think there's something within us and as humans that is drawn to prayer and connecting with something greater than ourselves. So it fascinates me because for the longest time I was outspoken in thinking that Christians obviously hadn't thought through what they believe. Really, I mean, I was very outspoken about thinking Christians were uneducated fools, to be honest. But there's something in us, I mean, that just draws us to pray. I'm always fascinated when an airplane takes off. Look around once at what people are doing. You'll see signs of the cross coming out from people who haven't set foot in a church in their entire lives. People all of a sudden will close their eyes and say something to themselves. It's just an amazing thing. It's like we're subtly praying, like, God, I hope this pilot knows what he's doing.
Right.
And even the Cubs game in the World Series, I've never seen more people pray at one time in my entire life. It was amazing, actually. They would show the stands, and I don't think the people were actually joking around. They weren't doing it for show for their friend. It was like a prayer meeting at the Game 7, you know? And even when our loved one is you know, going in an ambulance to the hospital, or we're going back for a simple procedure that is not even something scary, as we're being wheeled back, for some reason, there's something inside of us that begins to pray. So I think it will connect with anybody. And actually, that would be the person that I would be so honored to read it, especially someone who's like, God, I'm not a Christian, and I really question God and God's existence as a whole. That person, I would be so honored if I pick it up.
So no judgments. You can pick up the book. We're not going to question your beliefs. You can still gain some things from it.
No judgments. It is a judgment-free book.
And we will then not judge you for your incomplete sentences, is it? That is your biggest?
I hope not. Or if you see me walking and talking to myself at night, don't judge me there either.
Okay, that sounds good. I think we can handle that. Adam Weber is lead pastor at Embrace Church in Sioux Falls. He has written a new book that comes out shortly. Adam, thank you for your time today and helping us understand how different people from different walks of life might be able to apply some of the teachings that you put out in your book.
Oh, awesome. I'm so grateful and honored.
Thank you.
Adam Weber's book, Talking with God, What to Say When You Don't Know How to Pray, hits shelves on March 21st.